Good morning. Coming up on 7:40 here on the Mighty 690, it is time for another Wednesday with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District, and we have joining us Holly Miner and Adavin Strunks. How are you ladies doing this morning?
Great. Good morning. Doing good.
Good to have you here. So staying warm enough, 20 degrees. It's a taste of winter here. So it was a little chilly for some of the trick-or-treaters running on last night, but they were still out, so that's always good. So, Holly, we're going to start off with you here first, and I know you've been kind of all over the place. Were both of you at the Kansas State for the actual, like, what do you call it? Is it your annual conference thing?
Annual conference.
Okay. Yeah, so all of us agents go up to that, all the agents across Kansas.
That's a lot. I mean, that's a bunch. So
it's a good time to get together and network with other agents and talk and discuss what's been going on and just to meet each other and... especially for people that are new and welcome them into the fold. So,
no, that's very cool. And I mean, the fact that, you know, that's going to be hundreds and hundreds of y'all. So that's really neat. So now good to have you back and everything. And Holly, I know you wanted to talk, you know, a little bit. You always like to talk some food safety or, you know, just kind of food topics in general. And we have something today about cutting and reducing recipes.
Yeah, so we're getting ready for the holidays, and you might have a recipe that you want to try, or you might think, well, I don't need two whole recipes. Maybe I just need 1.5 recipes. So some recipes can be reduced really easily. Others, when they have precise measurements, you might want to make just the whole thing and then maybe cut it in half and freeze half of that, or put it in individual portion sizes and put it in your freezer to save it for later. But a lot of recipes call for a standard egg, and an egg is actually 1/4 cup. So if you're cutting a recipe in half and it says 1 egg, you would take the egg and mix it up in a small bowl and then measure 2 tablespoons to use, and the rest of that you could put in the refrigerator and use within 2 days, or you know, put it in scrambled eggs or an omelet or something like that and use it that way. Foods like meatloaf can be mixed up, and then they can be portioned into individual serving sizes by maybe putting them in a muffin pan and then freezing them that way. And then when it's time to cook them, you just take them out and cook them in the oven, make sure they reach the internal temperature of 155 degrees to make sure that they're cooked all the way through and thorough. So that's a great way to do some of those meat dishes like that. You should never partially cook and then freeze any kind of meat, because it allows the bacteria to grow, and it doesn't kill all the bacteria in the food. So the bacteria can still grow, even though it slows down in frozen environment or in a refrigerated environment. It doesn't kill it, so it still has the potential to grow when it warms back up. And we want to make sure that when we're cooking any meats, that we cook them to the correct internal temperature. And then if you're using a 9x13 pan and you're cutting a recipe in half, you might use an 8x8 or round 9x2 inch pan. The thing that you want to keep in mind when you're doing recipe cutting is the size of the pan, and keep the depth of the dish the same as what it would be in the original. So if the food is usually 2 inches thick, then keep the food 2 inches thick in the new pan that you're using. And then the temperature, if you're baking something in the oven, would probably be the same. But if you're using a dark glass pan or a dark metal pan, you want to reduce the temperature 25 degrees, and that'll prevent it from over-browning or overcooking. And sometimes when you reduce a recipe and you're using a smaller pan, it might take a little bit less time to cook. So you want to set your timer about halfway through and then check it, and then continue to cook it until it reaches that safe internal temperature, minimum temperature if it's a food product such as meat or eggs or fish or something like that. And then if we're using herbs and spices or any kind of seasonings, usually it's a safe bet to reduce them a little bit more than half. And then if you think it doesn't have quite enough, then you can add some more back in. But spices tend to be pretty strong when you reduce a recipe, so cutting them a little bit more than half when you're cutting something in half is a good guide for that. So we were talking a little bit before we went on air about how many cups are in a gallon and how many cups are in a pint or a quart. And so there's 16 cups in a gallon. There's 2 cups in a pint and 2 pints in a quart. So there's 4 cups in a quart. And a quart is 1/4 of a gallon. So you take those 4 cups and then take that times 4. That equals 16. So
I think I need a chart when I, you know, to be able to remember that. And I know there's plenty out there.
Yeah. So for those kids out there that think that they are never going to use math, when you're cooking food, you are using math all the time. So and science, it's actually a science of putting food together and cooking it.
So. All right. So what about when we get into these thirds and everything like that, like a third measure of, you know, a third of a cup or that sort of thing.
Right. So a third of a cup is 5 tablespoons and 1 teaspoon. And each tablespoon has 3 teaspoons in it. So half of a third of a cup would be 2 tablespoons and 2 teaspoons.
Oh, okay. That's not that hard.
Yeah. So that's the other one. That the when a recipe has a big T in it, that's a tablespoon. When it says TSP, that's a teaspoon. So a lot of people, those are confusing. And for me, even sometimes they're confusing if the recipe is handwritten. You might look at it and go, oh, is that supposed to be a tablespoon or a teaspoon?
Sure.
So tablespoons usually have a capital T, and they're 3 teaspoons.
Well, and I don't think that equivalent, you know, people knowing how much, you know, how many tablespoons and teaspoons are in a third of a cup. I feel like that's not very well known. This is honestly the first time I've actually heard that.
I have a refrigerator magnet that I keep on the refrigerator. It's just a nice little thing to go back and say, oh yeah, I'm right. I got this down. It's 5 1/3. And then it helps you to be able to calculate that. I also keep a substitution list on the inside of the cabinet door. So like if you run out of baking powder, then maybe you can substitute baking soda and a little bit of vinegar for that. Or if you need to make something like a sour cream, you would use milk and a tablespoon of vinegar. So it's nice to have the substitution list handy too when you're baking a lot of food and we're getting ready to do that this time of year, and you run out of something. It's nice to know what you can substitute for that food.
That's a great reminder. You know, some of those as we talk about Thanksgiving, stores might not be open, or store may be a long ways from you, and the nearest neighbor's a ways too. So
that's right.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about is, so when we talk about maybe something that's being baked, do you ever have to adjust any of those baking times as far as, you know, since you're maybe cooking a lot less than what the original recipe talks about?
Yeah, so if you're cutting a recipe in half, you may want to reduce the amount of time or set a timer for half of the time. And then check it at that point, and then continue to check it. And, you know, you can stick a toothpick in a cake or a loaf of bread, a quick bread, to see if it's sticky. If it comes out sticky, then you know it's not done yet. And so you bake it a little bit longer. I had a loaf of banana bread that I made the other day, and I actually ended up baking that about 20 minutes more than what the recipe said because I put a few too many bananas in it. Oh. I had some extra bananas and I just threw them all in there, and it took a lot longer for it to bake. It was still really good, but I shouldn't have added those extra bananas. So some things you can, you know, if you're making a casserole, you can kind of fudge on the ingredients and mix a few things in or not mix as much of something, and it turns out okay because it's a casserole. But if you're baking a pie or cookies or bread or a cake or something like that, you really need to measure those ingredients and make sure that you're following that recipe pretty closely.
Oh, that's a great reminder. And there are a lot of those neat recipes out there that you run into that, you know, there's even whole recipe books I know for feeding large groups, but you might run across one of those recipes that, yeah, it would be really neat, but you know, it's a lot of, you know, you don't want to make 200 of something.
Right.
So it is nice to be able to cut that down.
Yeah. And normally you can cut everything in half. like I said, with the egg, you know, you just figure out what that egg is supposed to be, a fourth of a cup, and then cut it down from there. I cut a recipe for French bread down this summer and ended up not having enough batter to batter the French bread. So some of those recipes, you might not be able to cut it quite down as half. You can cut the bread down, but maybe not the you know, the liquid amount that you were going to dip the bread in to make the French bread or French toast.
So you mentioned the difficulty in maybe some reading some of these handwritten recipes. Is there anything else that you run into with some of these older recipes and maybe some terminology that might be different than what we're used to today?
Yeah, so a pinch. A lot of times a pinch is a little bit different. I think my mom had a recipe that said a box of powdered sugar. So powdered sugar used to come in boxes. And you're like, well, how much is a box of powdered sugar? Well, a box is about a pound. So a pound of powdered sugar is what it would be. So then you just have to look on your bag of powdered sugar and see how much a pound is, and then do your best estimate. And a lot of those kinds of recipes were for frosting. And so frosting, you always mix it up according to the thickness or the consistency that you want it to be when you're spreading it. So, you know, some of those things you don't have to be precise on the measurement, which helps out a lot.
But, I mean, I've even seen some of these old recipes are like, cook over a medium fire. And I'm like, well, I guess if you have a gas stove, that'll work. But I'm like, electric land, it's, I don't know, medium. So.
Yeah. And it take, you know, with a gas stove, you can shut the heat off right away, where an electric stove, the burner stays hot for a lot longer. So, you know, moving it off the heat would probably help to keep things from burning on the bottom of the pan. I think, you know, when you're making something in a pan like that, stirring it to make sure that it's not sticking on the bottom is going to be key to seeing how fast it cooks and stuff like that. So, yeah.
No, great reminders. Well, anything else that we should know about this?
Not this, but I do want to announce a class that I have coming up.
Yeah.
We have a Master Food Volunteer training coming up. Our applications are due the 1st of December, and so that's coming up just a few weeks away here. And we would love to have anybody that's interested in helping with cooking or interested in food to join us. It's the Master Food Volunteer program is kind of like our Master Gardener program. You take the training. Our training is online, so you don't have to travel anywhere to take it. You can take it in the comfort of your own home. And it's a 6-week long training, and it starts in January. And once the training is done, then you volunteer back 40 hours to the program. You get all sorts of fun things like an apron and a name tag, and I give some little gifts away to our Master Food Volunteers, and then they help with things like the Kitchen Kids camps that we do in the summertime, or the food preservation classes that we have, or any other things that we have going on. So it's a great way to be involved in the community and give back to your community if you are interested in food. And a lot of times it's those people that are retired, but they're not really, really ready to just sit on the couch yet. So they have some time to give and enjoy being around people. And it's a great way to be around kids as well. So
yeah, that's a great opportunity. So and if people are interested in getting signed up for that, what's the best way to do that?
So they can call our office at 620-331-2690, or they can give me a call or email me at haminer@ksu.edu. And they can also look on our website, and it's underneath our events. And there's an application that they would need to fill out, and then a sheet that says a little bit more detail what all is involved in the program. So,
excellent. Well, Holly, I always like to ask you a bonus question when you're here, because it always comes up with something. So kind of getting into crock pot time, people mm-hmm. are starting to think about some of that. Myself, if ever I try to like cook a stew with like potatoes, or maybe something with like pinto beans or whatever, I can never get them to not be crunchy. I feel like, am I just being impatient? I mean, what's the best advice?
Oh, goodness. So beans are hard because you need to soak them overnight a lot of times to get them. And so if you're putting them in the crock pot and you're heating it up, it may not allow them to soak up enough water without having heat on it. That might be why they're crunchy. I don't cook a lot of beans. Mm-hmm. So
the canned ones are just so much easier.
Yeah. But I do know that when you are cooking with beans or something like that, noodles, they soak up a lot of moisture. And so you have to be real careful about making sure that you're not cooking your crock pot isn't cooking dry. So one of the nice things about cooking in a crock pot, it is a moist heat. There's lots of liquid in the crock pot, and that helps cook the food. So you really want to make sure that you have enough liquid in there to sustain that, especially when you're cooking like with noodles or beans or something. And then if you are cooking with noodles, you want to add them towards the end. You don't want to put them in at the beginning, because they'll just, that starch will break down and it will just be like glue.
Oh yeah. No, so. I accidentally overcooked some spaghetti here and I was like, this is bad. This is like usually it's the other way around. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is way too much. It's too mushy.
Yeah. I like crock pots because you can put it in, you can forget about it and let it go. You don't have to worry about it. It's great when you have to work and you can come home to it. Now, I will say that I just read an article not too long ago about a certain brand of crock pot that started on fire in someone's house because it had an electrical short. So, you know, there are always those considerations, those things to think about when you are working with appliances. There is the potential for a fire hazard. So, you know, my grandmother lived next to a lady who's, at this time of year, we have a lot of people that are frying their turkeys in fryers. And they put the turkey in the fryer, had too much oil in it, dripped over the side, started a fire in their garage, and they ended up burning their house down. Mm. And that was probably 20 years ago, but I can remember that because it was right next to my grandmother. And that's not a very good way to start your holiday season off. So, you know, be careful out there if you are going to fry a turkey for Thanksgiving. Make sure that you put the bird in and know about how much water will hold, your fryer will hold, and then don't overfill your fryer with oil. You know, make sure that you're doing that. And then, you know, I'm not going to be here before Thanksgiving, I don't think. So thawing your turkey about 4 to 5 pounds, it takes an hour to thaw 4 to 5 pounds of turkey. So you want to make sure that you're allowing enough time to thaw that turkey. It might take several days to thaw a 20-pound bird, five days maybe. So, you know, don't wait until Thanksgiving Day or the day before Thanksgiving to buy your frozen turkey and then think you're going to have it thawed by the next day, because it won't. It won't work.
No, it just won't. So, no.
And you want to thaw it in the refrigerator.
Yeah, not.
Or under cold running water.
Not just on the counter.
No, not on the counter.
Bad idea.
Outside of the bird gets thawed, room temperature, bacteria starts to grow, the inside is still frozen. Not a good idea. Then you would have the turkey trots.
Yeah,
and that's not something we
want
to do
we
either.
We don't want that. All right. Well, Holly, again, appreciate you coming on here. I'm bummed we won't get to see you probably until after Thanksgiving. But, hey, we always enjoy when you're around, and appreciate you coming on. Daven Strontz up next. And what do you have for us, Daven?
I'm going to be talking about feeding pumpkins to livestock.
Okay. Very good. I mean, that sounds good. I was like, feeding pumpkins on Halloween, that'd be a little scary. So, all right. We're at clear Halloween now. So we got more coming up next. Good morning, 8:11 here as we continue on the Mighty 690, our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension. Joining us once again, we have Holly Miner and Daven Strontz. Good morning once again, ladies.
Good morning.
So, Daven, you're up at bat here, and you know, Halloween's over. As sad as it is, hard to believe, it's November already. It's like, this is one of those things where it's like, November is a big change between October. I feel like it's just mentally. So I know we've got lots of folks out there who have a lot of pumpkins, and they might have a use for those.
Yeah, so if you have a lot of pumpkins, or maybe a friend has a lot of pumpkins that they're looking for a way to recycle after they're done using them as decorations, or maybe you carve some jack-o'-lanterns, and in a few days you'll be looking for a way to recycle them. So if you have livestock or chickens, or you know someone who does, you may talk to them, because pumpkins are safe to feed. However, it is recommended that the stem is removed from the pumpkin, as it could potentially be a choking hazard for smaller livestock like sheep or goats. Now, if the pumpkin has been carved or decorated for Halloween, it might not be safe to feed, because sometimes people will dip their jack-o'-lanterns in, or soak them in, bleach to help them last longer. And then, of course, it's not safe to feed because it could make animals sick. Or you want to watch for any wax that is left on them, or if they have been painted. If the whole pumpkin hasn't been painted, then you can cut off the part that hasn't been painted and feed that portion of it to livestock or chickens. Now, kind of the challenge of feeding pumpkins is that they're bigger and they kind of have a tough exterior. Unless they're starting to go bad and get softer, then they might break open if you were to, you know, throw them over the fence into the pasture. So larger livestock like horses and cattle, sometimes they can be given a whole pumpkin and they'll kind of roll it around and play with it and eventually break it open and eat it. But if you have smaller livestock like sheep and goats and chickens, you'll want to cut that pumpkin apart for them to make it easier for them to eat, and of course for the chickens to peck on. And if your animals have never been fed pumpkins before, or squash or zucchini, they may just kind of look at it and not do much with it for a day or so. And then hopefully you'll have one that's curious and will try it out and get the rest of the herd to try it out as well. Another tip that I read is that you can also bake the pumpkin to make it softer for the animals to eat. So if you want to do that, they recommend heating your oven to 400 degrees, and then typically a 3 to 6 pound pumpkin usually takes about 45 minutes to an hour to become soft, but if you cut the pumpkin into slices before baking, it can reduce that cooking time. And another kind of topic I wanted to touch on related to pumpkins is in the sheep and goat producer community, sometimes pumpkin is talked about as a natural dewormer. And there is, you know, research being done on that, but so far no research has proven that that's a fact. So don't rely on it as a natural dewormer for your livestock. But they do contain some good vitamins, such as vitamins A and E, and are also a good source of fiber for animals.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I have seen a goat eat most of a pumpkin in one sitting, although this was probably about the fattest goat in Greenwood County. But, it was, and then after that, it started eating a bench. So, you know, they're pretty.
Sounds like it was very hungry.
Yeah, it was the very hungry goat. It'd be a good children's book. But yeah, no, that's really interesting. And of course, a great use for some of those pumpkins. I mean, And Holly, feel free to chime in, because I know some people, you know, they might buy a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin thinking, oh, I can make a pie out of this. Mm-hmm. And having tried that before, I can tell you it doesn't usually work out very well.
Yeah, pumpkin pie is usually made from squash, not pumpkins. So the canned pumpkin that you get in the store is probably not really very much pumpkin in it. It's probably mostly just squash, but... And the other thing is a food safety thing. If you've cut your jack-o'-lantern, then you probably don't want to use it for pumpkin pie.
Yeah, no, that's probably not a good idea. Well, we do have the little pie pumpkins, which are probably are just a little bit better maybe for a pie.
Yeah. Or... Well, my mom used to take her pumpkins, and she would cut them like you were saying, Dave, and cut them into slices because the shell is so hard, and then she'd cook it, and then that would be how she'd be able to get the shell off to be able to make, because my mom did use pumpkin for pumpkin pie, so our pumpkin pie was a little bit different when I was a kid, but yeah.
And so even if you're, you know, you're feeding to animals, that sort of thing, it's not like you have to stick the whole pumpkin in the oven. Even if it would fit, you could cut it up. And
yeah,
sort of
exactly.
Thing.
You can cut it up because, like Holly said, the outer skin is pretty tough. So that's the part that especially smaller livestock have a hard time chewing through.
Well, and then even the seeds, they could definitely eat the seeds as well, you know?
Yeah, so. The seeds, the whole innards of the pumpkin, they can eat that as well. And I mean, it's past the time for zucchini and squash, but if you have an overabundance of that in your garden, you can always feed that to livestock as well.
I've even heard that for the folks who have pigeons, that the pigeons actually eat the seeds as well. Is another thing that they can be fed to them. So.
Yeah, I know when I've tried feeding pumpkin before to my goats and they kind of looked at it, they weren't too sure about it. So I don't know if birds ate it or they ate it, but it was gone within a couple days.
Okay, well, very good. That's excellent. So did you have any events or anything else to tell us about today, Ben?
So one topic I just wanted to talk about real quick, speaking of birds, is the Department of Ag released just another reminder about avian influenza, also referred to as bird flu. And of course, last summer we heard a lot about this because unfortunately it was really moving through. And this time of year, wild birds are migrating. And occasionally, because of that increased movement of birds, there's a higher risk for your backyard flocks to get it. Just some signs to watch out for is coughing or sneezing, difficulty breathing, lack of energy, depression, and decreased feed or water intake. And then swelling or purple discoloration of head, eyelids, comb, wattle, and legs. And then decreased egg production. And of course, sudden or unexplained death. So of course, this is a bad deal. Hopefully no one has to deal with it. But just a few things you can do to help protect your flock is avoid attracting wild birds and waterfowl to your home. So if you have any feed that has spilled, keep that cleaned up. Our ponds are pretty low still, unfortunately, so we don't have as big of a problem with those attracting like duck or geese to your property, but maybe try and keep your chicken coop away from any ponds. And then try to not move birds from farm to farm very often. And, of course, quarantine those new birds that you get in.
That's a very good reminder here. And I know that, you mentioned migration and everything. I just happened to think, did you catch the butterfly, the monarchs going through?
I did not.
So it was a couple weeks ago. I was like, oh, my gosh, there were just tons of them. It was just wild. So that's always kind of cool as they go to Mexico. So we get to see that. It's pretty wild. Any events or anything else that you wanted to do today?
Yes, so we do have a cattle feeding, a winter feeding event coming up on November 14th that evening in Girard. It's free to attend and dinner will be provided. And Dr. Jamie Lynn Farney will be the speaker at that event and she'll be talking about limit feeding and other strategies.
Okay, well, very good. And Holly, did you want to talk real quick about your events coming up that are on the way?
Yeah, so November 13th, we have a Serve Safe Food Handler training. So anybody that works in a food service establishment, that would be a great training for them. It's in Girard, and it is in the morning. And then on November 16th, we have a food manager's training. So food safety for those people that are managing food service establishments. And that training is an all-day training, and it is in Pittsburgh. And they can call our office for more information about either one of those or look them up on our website.
Okay. Well, a great reminder. Well, ladies, it's been a pleasure. Good to have you in studio here, and look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
All right. Thanks to David and Holly. You have a good one. And we do have Open Line on the way here on the Mighty 690. We got an early bird edition of that. And then we'll be talking with Candy Westbrook from the Coffeyville Chamber of Commerce straight ahead.